From the KGOU studios, I'm Brian Hartzinski, sitting in for Suzette Grelot, who's in France, and welcome to Worldviews. Suzette will join me from Paris to talk about what she's seen in the European city in just the few weeks after the coordinated terrorist attack by ISIS militants.
Tensions have eased a little bit. Now they're more sad than anything else. And I kept hearing over and over again how defiant they are.
Then I'll talk with oil analyst Ed Morse. He calls North America the new Middle East, taking over the role of swing producer from Saudi Arabia.
That's a remarkable change. It's a combination of two things that are North American related. The production side of North America and the capital markets of North America are playing the role of swing producer.
Changing oil markets and applying lessons from the 1980s to today. But the news is coming up next. This is Worldviews. I'm Brian Hartzinski, and I'm joined by Suzette Grelot, who's actually in Paris right now. And Suzette, what I'm curious about is the reaction in Paris since the November 13th terrorist attacks that killed 130 people in a series of coordinated attacks on sports venues, concert theaters, places like that. It's been about a month now. You're in Paris. What are you seeing? What are you encountering?
Well, first of all, my trip here, Brian, I took the train, the Eurostar, from London, and the security was significant. I've taken that train several times, and it was noticeably more strict, and I could tell just getting onto the train to come to Paris. There's a very visible military and police presence on the streets of Paris compared to what I've seen in the past. But I would say, you know, it's been a few weeks. It's the holidays, you know, are coming. Everything's lit up. People are out. I don't detect that it's quiet like it had been before. People, I think, are starting to ease up a little bit.
Since you're in Paris as part of your day job as the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, you're interacting with students, you're interacting with alumni. What's been their reaction? Have these attacks changed their behavior at all? What have they told you about what they were doing before and what they've done since? Are they more worried? Has this affected their habits, their mood, things like that?
Yeah, this is very interesting. I met with a group of OU students studying abroad here in Paris last night, along with several of our alums. And the initial impression that they had, they were all shocked and very, you know, sad and disappointed and upset about the events. But they were kind of surprising just how awkward and eerie it was and quiet the city is. I mean, Paris is a big city. It's very populous. There were a lot of people here, and it's never quiet. And so the quietness of the city was unnerving to them. That was kind of their initial reaction. Of course, there was a lot of nervousness. People seemed to be very suspicious. You know, they would take the metro and would be very concerned. Everybody's kind of looking at each other. They said they got really jumpy. They would hear police sirens and everybody would kind of stop and, you know, wait for a second. I mean, it was just obviously very on edge. But as I said before, you know, they now say that tensions have eased a little bit. Now they're more sad than anything else. One of our alums, who's a Parisian, she said that she's just so sad that this attack obviously happened, that the attack on this beautiful home in Paris, and these attempts to change, you know, who they are and what they do. And I kept hearing over and over again how defiant they are. Both the French alums that were students at OU and the students here are defiant. They said they will never leave the city, they will never leave this country, and they will be happy, as they said. This is a quote from one of the students, to die for her country if she needs to. So they're nervous, they were on edge, they're now sad and absolutely standing their ground. It's very interesting.
Sounds very similar to some of the reaction we saw in Oklahoma City in 1995 and then New York in 2001. That's Suzette Grelot. She's our regular host, and she's traveling in Paris. Suzette, thank you for joining me.
See you soon.
You can find all of these conversations and our past episodes online at kgou.org. We've also shared them on Facebook, and we've tweeted it at Worldviews KGOU and at KGOU News. And you can follow me and Suzette on Twitter at Brian Hartzinski and at Suzette Grelot. Our segments are also downloadable from our website and iTunes, where you can also subscribe to our weekly podcast. After a short break, I'll talk with oil analyst Ed Morse. He spent nearly four decades following the international energy trade and will discuss how the current crisis compares to what the world went through in the 1970s. I'm Brian Hartzinski, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Brian Hartzinski. My guest today is Ed Morse. He's currently the head of global commodities research at Citigroup in New York. 35 years ago, he was working in the U.S. State Department as the Assistant Deputy Secretary for International Energy Policy. Ed Morse, welcome to Worldviews.
Pleasure to be with you.
Ed, I'd like to start earlier in your career. You were the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Energy Policy in the late 1970s and early 1980s under both Presidents Carter and Reagan. Take me back 35 years. We were dealing with an energy crisis then, an Islamic revolution in Iran. I have a hard time imagining a more interesting time to be in that position.
It was a wonderful time to actually learn not only about the politics of energy, but really markets, because markets way back then were still controlled. There was no free market in energy. Yeah, Japan and Germany to some degree allowed prices to be freely formed. They were importers, so they didn't have much choice in that. But if you looked around the world, the United States had control prices at the wellhead, at the burner tip. And actually, that created an incredible amount of learning, because as a person in the government, when markets started to get liberalized, I knew as much about the markets as anybody in the world did, because there was no trading system involved.
And what changed? How did that evolve? How did those markets liberalize?
So the U.S. Decontrolled oil prices literally the day Ronald Reagan was inaugurated, although we were in the process of ramping up prices to world levels. And there were several things that happened as a result of that. One of the most critical issues was that in a world of fixed prices, where the prices were set essentially by OPEC countries internationally, they could adjust their volume to meet whatever the prices were. And as soon as the U.S., which was the largest energy-consuming country in the world then, as it still is, and the largest oil-importing country, as it no longer is, having ceded that to China, but it meant that was and had been a seller's market became overnight a buyer's market, not quite overnight, literally, but it became a buyer's market. And as a buyer's market, it was a market that foreign governments and foreign companies were competing against one another to have access to. It was also a rapidly growing market, so you wanted to have access to it. And as a result, in part of the growth in volumes in the U.S., which suddenly decontrolled the price of oil and gas, we had what naturally evolves with markets, a forward curve, a forward market, and then futures contracts actually started to be written on the New York Mercantile Exchange. And that was very revolutionary to the market, depriving producing countries of a lot of the freedom they had to determine prices.
Looking at today, as the price of oil continues to fall as it has over the past year, we've heard so many comparisons to the oil bust of the early 1980s. I wonder what lessons you or your colleagues have learned that you can apply to the current crisis, and what are some of the differences that you've noticed between now and 30 years ago?
Sure. There are two characteristics of these markets that I think are worth looking at. In many ways, Saudi Arabia is at the heart of the collapse in prices. Prices were softening because of the growth of non-OPEC production then, as was the case at the beginning of 2014. But it was a Saudi decision that triggered the really precipitous drop in prices in both instances. In the 1980s, the Saudis were keeping they were the keeper of the price of oil. The price of oil for OPEC was the Saudi market, 34-degree API Saudi light crude oil. And as new oil was coming into the market from Alaska, the North Sea, Russia, Mexico, the Saudis, in order to maintain that price, had to reduce their production. So they went from around 10 million barrels a day in 1981, similar to where the production is now. Keeping the price firm, they, by 1985, were producing 2.5 million barrels a day. And their lesson was very instrumental in what they did last year. Their lesson was, in a bear market, in an oversupplied market, the thing you don't want to do is lose market share. Because if you lose the market share, you will eventually have to see prices go down anyway, and then you'll have to struggle to get the market share back, as they did after 1985-86, because in 85-86, the Iran-Iraq war was still going on. By 1988, the war was over, and that oil came into the market in a big way, and the Saudis were struggling to keep market share. So in many ways, the trigger of the collapse was the same. It was a Saudi move. The first time, it was defensive. and they were in a corner because their production had fallen to the degree it had. This time, they didn't want to be in the corner. So it's sort of like the lessons that generals learn about past wars. The Saudis learned that in a bear market, go after market share. So that's one of the critical commonalities of both that period and this period. But there is really an amazing and critical difference between now and then that people tend not to focus on. Right now, we have an oversupplied market. It's a market that is a 94 or 95 million barrel a day market. Then the market was a 60 million barrel a day market. Then, as now, OPEC was about 30 million barrels a day of the market. But now their share of the market is a third rather than a half of the overall market. Today, even with this imbalance, the Saudis producing what they're producing, there's virtually no spare capacity in the world. So we have this kind of 2% oversupply in the market, but we have a market in which we can expect supply disruptions from countries that are squeezed by a lower price, whether it's Nigeria or Venezuela or Iraq, nobody really knows. But we're in an era of the challenge to the petrostate, and there is no real spare capacity. Then there was a lot of spare capacity. OPEC had been producing 30 million barrels a day. They went down to 15. So as the Saudis were fighting back for the market share, you could expect that the world would be in a very low price environment for a long time, given all of that spare capacity. Now, we know that $50 prices are not sustainable, $40 prices are less sustainable, and the world doesn't have this cushion of unproduced but producible oil behind it.
And you and your colleagues at Lehman Brothers kind of predicted this in the mid-2000s. Is that right? You and your research team put together a paper saying that these high oil prices, these $100 a barrel, $120 a barrel, that they weren't sustainable and eventually this was going to fall apart.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. We did a couple of pieces. One was called oil.com, arguing that the 150, which is closer to the mark of where oil prices hit, was unsustainable and bubble-like. And we were wrong as to where we thought prices would be going. We thought they'd fall to below 90 at a time when most of the consensus was oil prices were heading to $200 a barrel. They actually fell to the high $30 barrel level. They eventually rebounded to that $90 number, which we felt kind of comfortable about, given the cost of finding and developing oil and given some other measures of where fair market value is.
That's Ed Morse, the former Assistant Deputy Secretary of State for International Energy Policy. We're talking about some of the similarities and differences between the international energy crisis in the 1970s and 80s and the current global drop in the price of oil that started late last year. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Brian Hardzinski, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Brian Hardzinski, filling in for Suzette Grelot, who we heard from earlier this hour about what life has been like in Paris in the month after the November 13th terrorist attack. In this half of the show, I've been talking with Ed Morse. He's the head of global commodities research at Citigroup and has spent the past four decades following and studying the international energy trade. Here in the United States, these low oil prices translate into low gas prices for you, me, and the everyday consumer. What's it like in other countries that are oil rich, say Russia and Venezuela? How does this downturn affect those citizens?
Well, we have we're in a lucky position, as are most other so-called oil-consuming countries, in that we have a very low share of our GDP that is involved in energy. It's less than 10%, as opposed to a petrostate that has 80, 90% dependence in GDP of revenues from oil and natural gas. This hurts a country like Venezuela far more than it hurts a country like Russia for a couple of good reasons, but one of them to bear in mind is that they have a free-floating currency. A lot of the adjustment can happen through a free-floating currency, particularly, and here's the difference between Russia and Venezuela. In the case of Russia, virtually all of the operating costs and all of the capital costs are ruble-denominated. Ruble has depreciated close to 50% against the U.S. dollar, so the costs of finding and developing oil has actually gone down. And Russian production has actually gone up as a result of that factor. In Venezuela, most of their costs are not local currency related, but they are based on effectively the U.S. dollar. So they suffer doubly. Their consumer is hit, or the government is hit in Venezuela because they have very low controlled oil prices. They are actually an importer of petroleum products. So that puts a tremendous burden on a government budget to try to deal with the situation. Russia has a little bit of an adjustment ease through the currency that floats and through the local costs. But there are two costs of energy go up for the consumer, and Russia doesn't have the same privilege that the Middle East countries have in terms of stabilization funds. Russia's stabilization fund sits at around $145 billion this year. They are drawing down at a rate of $75 billion annualized. So that's a cushion for adjustment that Venezuela doesn't have. But they can look toward the end of the tunnel and see the day when that reserve is going to vanish. So they're in for a day of reckoning. They've got a couple of years to kind of work on how they adjust to it.
I want to go back to something you said at the beginning of our conversation, and you were describing how interconnected OPEC and the Saudis are. I watched a Bloomberg television interview you gave recently, and you and a panel were discussing the falling oil prices. And you said everything about OPEC revolves around Saudi domestic politics. What are we to make of the instability there right now? King Abdullah passed away recently. The current monarch is rumored to be in ill health. If there is a power vacuum, who steps up and how does OPEC's role change and what countries would fill that hypothetical void in leadership?
First of all, I wouldn't go too fast in saying that that Saudi Arabia is facing a period of deep instability. It's a country that has managed to adjust to changing circumstances rather remarkably. They've had very small number of kings over the last 75 years. There have been transitions from one king to the other, only one of which was a rough transition. So I'd say the Saudis are challenged, but the level of instability that some people fear is not all that large. Clearly, there are adjustments that have to be felt by and accommodated by the royal family. It's a large group of people. I suspect one of the accommodations that has to be made is an adjustment to effectively a smaller royal family, and how they do that remains to be seen. But clearly, if they think that we're in a lower price environment for a long time, and they've said publicly that they think that this is going to be a $70 world after all things are balanced out in the market, that's not an environment in which you can remain a petrostate. So they must take measures to adjust. They must take measures to change the dominance of oil in their national economy. Fortunately, they have neighbors who have done so quite successfully in the UAE, which is clearly a smaller country than Saudi Arabia, but right next door. They are only about half dependent on oil revenue as Saudi Arabia. Like Saudi Arabia, they have huge sovereign wealth investments around the world to draw down. But the Saudis have to find a way to do what the UAE has done in several respects. One is to end the controlling of oil prices, something that Venezuela and other OPEC countries have found it very hard to do. But the UAE has actually moved like that suddenly overnight to market pricing and the citizenship has adjusted to it. That takes a big burden off of a government in terms of subsidies. So the Saudis, I think, will clearly be moving in that direction. Another is to find ways to diversify the economy. The UAE has done it through energy-intensive industries and through tourism. Saudi Arabia will find it more difficult to do it through tourism, although they probably can push religious tourism to a significant degree, doubling, if not trebling, the earnings from that. So it'll be a struggle, but I wouldn't say that the legitimacy of the royal family itself has been challenged. The differences of views are emanating from different parts of the royal family rather than from society as a whole rebelling against the royal family.
Finally, in the short time we have left, I want to look ahead. You're now the head of global commodities research at Citigroup, and you're the lead author on a paper I have right here in front of me called Energy 2020, where you call North America the new Middle East. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, fortunately, I just reread a piece that I also wrote in 2012 where I was really specific about what I meant by that. And what I meant by that is something that impacts the state of Oklahoma a great deal. And it is that Saudi Arabia had been the swing producer of the world for a long time. It was the central banker of the world, so to speak, providing liquidity or adding barrels to the market when the market was short, taking away liquidity when the market needed to rebalance to take supply out of the system. North America is now the swing producer. That's a remarkable change. You could say that it's a combination of two things that are North American related. The production side of North America and the capital markets of North America are playing the role of swing producer. The shale revolution was significantly financed by risk capital, not generated by oil companies, but came out of debt or equity issuance through the financial services sector. That is not available in kind of any other oil patch of the world. We are seeing the first big adjustment to market imbalances since the shale revolution. Clearly, a lot of this imbalance is being absorbed by production in the U.S. It's a slow absorption of production, so it's a longer sweat out at a lower price, so long as the Saudis have abandoned the role of swing producer, which I think they have fairly permanently. But eventually the markets will balance. We're going to see capital less robustly coming into the sector for a while. But when prices go up, as they eventually will, we will see production swinging back in, and we'll see the financial community financing that renewed growth in U.S. production.
Ed Morse, whose career has taken him from the State Department to Wall Street as an international energy analyst, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure spending this time with you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Ed Morse, a longtime international oil industry analyst. You can find a link to that Energy 2020 study we just talked about on our website, kgou.org. This public radio station produces Worldviews with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Ivy Dyson will help with our digital content for the next week until her semester-long internship ends. On behalf of our regular host, Suzette Grelot, who joined me from France to talk about the aftermath of the Paris attacks a month later, I'm Brian Hardzinski. Thanks for joining us.